Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 130 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.FM or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990. Just follow the instructions and remember that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. And you can stay in touch with me by email, or you can send a message on the Infectious Myth on Facebook, or you can send a message on Twitter. If you would like to sponsor this show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, please consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges that you get to others. We are living in the world of fake news, and we're getting it from both sides. So if you think I don't like fake news, and I like to think I don't, then I need support. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on science, on medicine, viruses, democracy, or social issues, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. Currently, you can donate via PayPal using david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com, or infectiousmyth.com/donate.php, not donate.html, like I said previously. Now let's get back to the second part of my discussion with James Lyons-Weiler. He's the president and CEO of the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge, a not-for-profit organization that conducts research in the public interest. He has a PhD in ecology, evolution, and conservation biology, and a postdoctoral degree in computational molecular biology. He's author of Ebola, An Evolving Story, and Cures versus Profits. And he's co-author with Richard Fry of the book where we are going to talk about the environmental and genetic causes of autism. This is a continuation of part one, and if you remember when we left off, James was just getting to the subject of the number of papers that show some kind of a connection between vaccines and autism. Let's get back to that.
No, because I wanted to whittle the thousands, the mass volume of studies down to three studies, right? So I have a website, jameslyonsweiler.com, with a link, human studies that indicate autism vaccine link. I wrote this article before I wrote the book, Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism. I went to the literature with a fresh set of eyes, and I found study after study after study after study, and I actually haven't counted them, but there's at least, I
More
want
than
to say,
20?
two dozen. Yeah, not two dozen. One. Let me count them. So we have Gallagher and Goodman. You count them for me, okay? Gallagher and
Yes.
Goodman, DeLong, Sharp, Toblanogic, Young, Nataf, Yasuda, Blaurock, Bush, Molina, Bradstreet, McDonald, Singh, Holmes, Lee, Vargas, Seneff, and Pauling.
Okay, I get 18,
Okay.
but I may not have counted that correctly. But you know, in the most generous way of looking at it, we've got a similar number of studies. But science should not be done by weighing the studies on both sides. The question is what is the data? And the IOM has basically said that the majority of the 20 studies that the CDC came up with are not really valid for making the determination of whether there's a link or not.
Right. The IOM also said something. I pored over their reports. The IOM also said something that was rather odd. They said that these correlation studies, association studies, are strong studies. They're not strong studies. Part of my motivation for reading the 2,000 studies that I did read was to look at the molecular etiology or the processes involved at the cellular level to find out what could possibly be happening. in the human brain.
Etiology, I don't think I was clear. Etiology meaning the study of how things are caused.
Yes, etiology, the mechanism.
The mechanism by which something is caused. Yeah, okay, continue.
So association studies are actually extremely weak, extremely amenable to manipulation, okay? The proper type of study would be a randomized clinical trial.
Mm-hmm.
We're told that that's unethical because it would deny people access to vaccines. But you see, that's just a gambit.
Well, that's actually very common in medicine, is like we've got proven. I guess the same thing happens in HIV/AIDS. We have proven drugs, therefore we will not allow you to do a placebo-controlled trial. But if you want to say, well, I don't really believe the evidence that approved that first drug, they just go back to the ethical argument, like we can't deny people life-saving drugs. And if you
right.
question
well, it's a standard of care argument. The difference with vaccines is that they certainly could identify 1,000 people who don't want to vaccinate their child very easily.
Yes.
And they could randomly choose out of those 1,000 cases, individuals that are controls that match cases that they also randomly choose.
Right.
Do it for different ethnic groups. These studies should have been done 15 years ago, and they should be done every year for the next 15 years, where we do randomized clinical trials that are semi-randomized because, okay, fine, there's people who didn't vaccinate. Now, that's called self-selection, and it could induce a bias. There's no doubt about it.
Yes, you're right.
The way that you avoid the bias is you say, okay, we're going to match patients across groups, and there's standard ways to do that. Now, the association studies that the IOM said were very strong are actually very, very weak. The better evidence of autism result is in the animal studies and in the cell line studies that actually show us exactly how. And I would like to share with
interruption? We're coming to the end of an hour. Now, I can go on, and we can do another half hour or so if you've got the time. If we're just going to do one show, I have to cut it off pretty soon. But I'm happy to keep going because, like, this is interesting. I still have a lot of questions to ask you.
Okay. Well, your call. It's your show.
Yeah, if you're willing to continue, let's continue.
Okay. So let's say that you have one or two of these mutations that confer environmental susceptibility to toxins.
Mm-hmm.
You have a baseline level of toxicity because you're a human being on the planet. I mean, this is everyone.
Right.
You find PCBs in the blood of people in the Amazon rainforest, right?
And in the Arctic, yes. It's sadly true.
Right. So we have this baseline exposure. Human beings cannot tolerate an infinite number of diversity of types of toxins. You have this baseline, and you just happen to be an individual who couldn't detoxify very well. During growth and development, body weight is really important when it comes to how many toxins you can handle, right? Because
right.
if you're very small, the dose matters, right? So dose matters, but weight matters. So you have to consider dose per kilogram.
Mm-hmm.
These individuals are exposed on the first day of birth now with hepatitis B,
right.
Just like everybody else. They're exposed to a level of toxicity in aluminum that exceeds the FDA regulation by far, if you consider the body weight. Right now, the guidelines for vaccination don't consider body weight. Unbelievably so, they don't do it.
That's a really important point because, you have preemies that have, what, a half, a third, a quarter the body weight of a bruiser who's born. Like, I was 10 pounds at birth. I don't know what that is in kilograms. But, you know, compare me to a preemie. Like, how much would a preemie weigh? Like, 2 pounds?
Well, maybe. I mean, you know, the median weight in pounds of U.S. males is 7.8 pounds. So if a premature baby is born and is low birth weight, they should probably not be vaccinated, right? Because
mm-hmm,
of the dose.
Mm-hmm.
But what I just told you is that the aluminum toxicity of the hepatitis B, the amount of toxin put in the body exceeds per weight the FDA regulated limit. But nobody knows that. We're just doing that study right now. And so individuals who have the inability to detoxify as well as others, many people clear that out. So the clearance rate estimates are available. Many
right.
people clear that out. Most of it over the first couple of days or week or so, probably 90%, 80 to 90% over the first week or so. But much of it stays in the body for a long period of time.
Including in the brain?
Yes. The macrophages pick up aluminum preferentially. They deposit it there in the brain, and it can stay there for decades.
And aluminum is, like mercury, is a metal. And, of course, the brain is an electrical organ, so one would expect that to have pretty negative consequences.
Right. So what it's an electrochemical organ, right? So we and biological systems, we use all of that. All of our organs use all of that. But the point is we have these toxins that are accumulating in the brain, and at some point in time, the cells in the brain that recognize traumatic brain injury or recognize infection start picking up the signal that there's something really wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be due to the fact that many cells are dying and they put off cytokines. With increased cell death, you get cytokine release. There are specialized cells in the brain called microglia.
Mm-hmm.
These microglia are normally very, helpful to us. They have two phases or two states. In the first state, they actually help the brain make connections. They are waiting around for an infection or a brain injury so that they can then become activated and clear out the debris. They act like macrophages in the brain. The macrophage is like a white blood cell that engulfs
right.
their cells and bacteria and viruses. So if you have these brain injuries, traumatic brain injury, stroke, viral infection, people who study neurology and diseases of the brain and conditions of the brain absolutely know that microglia become activated as a result of these kinds of injuries. If you get a chemical injury or this type of a metal injury, then you also see microglia activated. There's a study by Vargas et al. That showed that chronic microglial activation is present in brains of autistics from the age of like 5 to 25. Okay? That's seen at autopsy.
And so, one of the points, I've interviewed a couple of experts on aluminum, Chris Shaw and Chris Exley, and both of them made the point that there are no biological systems that contain aluminum. So there's no way that your body knows how to properly get rid of something that's not, part of life.
Oh, I think we get rid of aluminum all the time. I agree with them that there's no biological use of aluminum that's ever been established. It's universally toxic.
Right, I guess a metal, but it's like mercury. It's like there's a metal form of mercury and there's the biological form, ethyl or methyl mercury.
It certainly is a vitamin. It certainly, isn't a nutrient or a supplement.
Right.
It's not good for the cell to have aluminum around.
But we actually have biologically activated the aluminum. I guess that's the point I was trying to make. In order for it to be an adjuvant, it has to actually be biologically active or it couldn't affect the immune system. So the aluminum that we're exposed to in a vaccine is not really like you would get aluminum out of drinking water or something.
Both forms are biologically active, but the one that they put the types that they put in the vaccine are specifically more biologically active. The aluminum hydroxide is used in particular because it's very biologically reactive and it adheres to tissue very well. It stays around and it keeps the antigen around long enough for the immune system to find it. So both Chris Shaw and Chris Exley are certainly experts in this. What I wanted to say is that we do detoxify aluminum from our body, not
mm-hmm.
all of it. There forever. And so these kids that have these mutations can't do that as well. They
mm-hmm.
can't do it for aluminum, maybe specifically for aluminum, depends on the mutation. They can't do it for other types of toxins. There may be that they're more susceptible to one type of toxin or the other. Nevertheless, the cumulative effect of a dose after dose after dose after dose of vaccine is to get these microglia activated, state called chronic microglial activation. Russell Blaylock talked about this some
mm-hmm.
years ago. At that point, it was a theory, and now more data. The chronic microglia are activated, and they destroy dendrites specifically. These are growths out of nerve cells that are trying to make connections at the axon, okay? They're trying to make a synapse, I mean, not an axon. So the dendrite and the axon connect at a synapse. The dendrites are preferentially destroyed by microglia and trimmed, and they also destroy neural precursor cells. So the citation for that is in my book.
Mm-hmm.
This was fascinating to me. So we have developing brains. We need neural precursor cells. These are baby nerve cells to grow a healthy brain. And we activate the cells that end up destroying the brain. And some kids, it happens all the time, every day with everyone. Microglia activation happens in the brain all the time.
Right.
But this is chronic, and it's systemic, and it's widespread. These kids end up with brains that are very different than neurotypical brains. The kids' brains are what I call unipolar. Rather than complex synapses, when you and I learn something, like if I were to tell you I was born in upstate New York, Ogdensburg, New York,
mm-hmm.
remember that tomorrow, it's because you have a complex structure of a synapse that remembered that. When you forget that, that complex synapse will have dissolved away. The complex synapse is a redundant synapse with multiple dendrons hitting multiple exons, and there's feedback loops in there. So if, you know, the startle reflex that everyone has, you're mm-hmm. startled, that's a signal that goes into the brain very rapidly, very fast, and goes very far and very deep into the neural cortex. That's why we jump.
Right.
Okay. That jumpiness happens in autistic kids all the time because they don't have complex synapses to give the feedback so they get the saturation effect. You know, if you're sitting on a chair right now listening to the program, you're probably not thinking about the chair because your body has told you that the chair is there.
Right.
And over, you know, instantaneous, a million instantaneous signals from all the nerve cells, millions and millions of them are saying that you're sitting on a chair and your body, you know, stops sending the signal because your brain says, okay, I got it.
Yeah, right? I figured this out. I worked with a woman who had come from a country with a revolution, and there had been a lot of fighting in the city before they left, and she was much more jumpy. I worked in a very noisy environment, and there were suddenly sometimes quite loud noises, and it didn't really bother me, but she would get really traumatized by it. I mean, that was a way of sort of learned stress, right? Like, she'd heard bombs going off and bullets and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But with a child with autism, it's obviously, it's not really learned. It's either environmental or genetic, and it doesn't seem plausible that it's genetic because we wouldn't have that much.
Further, it's biological and genetic and environmental. That's my point.
Right.
So for most of the kids, over 99%, 98-99% of kids, they wouldn't have gotten autism if they weren't given environmental exposure, because they would have grown fast enough to outpace the toxins,
right?
Right. Think about it. You've got plants that are growing in your garden, you know, weeds that are growing in your garden. And if you use a pesticide on them, which I don't, by the way, but if you use a pesticide on them when they're little, you use less of a dose, right? But if they're large, you have to spray the whole plant, and you know,
right.
who would ever do that in their garden? You're going to eat that. But so the point about the human brain then is, this simplified unipolar brain, we see kids with autism who are very sensitive to bright lights. They're sensitive to light, not just bright light. They're sensitive to loud noises. They walk around with headphones on and sunglasses and so on.
Right.
Their sensory systems can't say, okay, I've got the fact that fan is spinning. I understand that.
Right.
Like new information all the way through, and the information comes in so hard and so fast because there's no resistance due to feedback at the complex synapses that it makes it all the way into the motor neural cortex. This is the science that's done. I'm not making this up. I'm summarizing the science that's in the book.
Right.
Okay. The signal goes all the way to the motor neural cortex, and it can't help it but move, and so you get hand flapping.
Right.
You get repetitive motor motions. the fact that that's a symptom tells us that there's a biological difference in the brain.
Right, a malfunction in the brain.
Well, I mean, you could use the word malfunction. I'm not going to upset anybody. I'm going to say it's a difference. I'm going to go with the neurodiversity movement, and I'm going to say, okay, it's a difference. So what kind of child do you want to love? Do you want to love a child who's got this repetitive motion disorder? Yes, fine, no problem. I love them. Do you want to love a child who then got a treatment and stopped flapping their hands? Fine, I'll love them too.
Well, yeah, I mean, I see that as two completely different things. You know, I was lucky enough to have three healthy children, but if I had had, say, a child with Down syndrome, I would also have loved that child, or at least I hope. I guess I can't really say that for sure unless it's happened to me. But that doesn't mean that, you know, I wouldn't have wished that that child was, quote, normal and was, you know, had the full capabilities of a human being.
Right. And so when I say I go with the neurodiversity movement at that, I'm talking in semantics, right?
Yeah.
So if you want to call it different, if you want to call it a deformation, if you want to call it something, you know, that they want to put a connotation on and say you're insulting me because you're saying that my child is handicapped or disabled or my child is damaged, how dare you say that? Well, I don't. I just say that they're different, and
yeah.
This is how they're different. Okay. Now let's get away from the semantics and get back to the science. Do you want your child to go to work go to school,
right?
Not be able to socialize as well, not being able to learn as well, not being able to not be a distraction to their own educational environment experience because other kids are picking on them? Do you want that life for your child? Or do you want to admit that it's an environmental disorder and that something done to improve their symptoms?
I think the biggest stress deep down in a lot of these parents is what are they going to do when we're gone? The parents are thinking, you know, we're going to get old and die. And, you know, our son or daughter is going to be 20, 30 years younger than us, and we're not there anymore to look after them. I mean, I think that must be a huge stress on parents.
It's really interesting that you brought that up, because one of the ideas that I had when I realized that the scale of this problem of vaccine-induced autism, environmentally induced autism, you know, kids in the United States, their services, their access to services in many states run out after the age of 21.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the government's doing a terrible job of projecting out where the services are going to come from. And by services, I mean, you know, if you're a somewhat functioning autistic adult, you got to have a clean home. You got to have groceries. You know, you'd like to have some form of entertainment and perhaps some educational experiences and so on. Enrichment experiences are definitely worthwhile for everyone.
Right.
So the adult services include things like people coming to your house and just talking with you while you are doing the dishes or helping you do the dishes,
mm-hmm.
making sure that you're on schedule with, you know, the laundry or whatever.
Right.
Take grocery shopping. One of the ideas that I have, and hopefully we'll develop this out in 2017 to 2018, is a retirement-like investment fund for kids with autism, for parents of kids with autism who are concerned about their fates. I'm setting up a board of people who are very interested. These are all parents of kids with autism to oversee the process so that best practices services are made available and that the money's not going to somebody's uncle. There's no insider trading, no conflicts of interest here. And none of these kids end up in a shack somewhere with deplorable living conditions.
Maybe I'm more of a socialist, but I think society has an overall responsibility, especially if this is vaccine-induced. Like everybody, the vast majority of people who supported vaccines are partly responsible for this. But, the problem with government programs is it tends to be put them in a home funded by the government, which is probably not the best environment for somebody who's
I agree
reasonably
more than you know. I'm just one step ahead because we have we have this issue where if the government makes a promise, 50 years from now, who knows what it's going to be, and people are concerned. This is a 20-30 year investment thing in their children. So the details hopefully will be coming forward on that. I do agree 100% that if we as a society have benefited from protection from infectious diseases by vaccination, then we as a society owe all of that protection from infectious diseases, all of the loss that would have happened, all of the deaths, all of the suffering and sickness that would have happened due to infectious disease, if vaccines are protecting us from that burden, we owe an immense debt of gratitude to these kids with vaccine-induced autism and their families.
And that was supposed to be the purpose of the vaccine court. You come to court, you describe the damage caused by the vaccine, and we compensate you. And to a tune of several billion dollars, that's happened, but more people have been turned away than have actually been compensated, and that's not counting the people who didn't know that the court existed and didn't go until it was too late.
Exactly.
Let's change the subject a little bit. You talked about some other things that aren't vaccines that could exacerbate or have an influence on autism. One of them was things like acetaminophen, which are fever-reducing agents. I mean, do you think there's a role in autism or other disorders from reducing fevers that occur after vaccination?
So many parents wanting to do the right thing with their kids wanted to avoid any fever due to the vaccine, so they would give their kids acetaminophen before the vaccine or after the vaccine.
Right.
And the knowledge, the scientific knowledge, the medical knowledge, is that Tylenol, a form of acetaminophen, and any other form of acetaminophen, depletes glutathione. And glutathione is an excellent protector of the brain, and it allows all the other systems to work well. And so, now if you end up with a double dose of a vaccine followed by acetaminophen, you unknowingly might be doing much more damage than good.
And acetaminophen is one of the biggest causes of liver failure or liver damage. There's an FDA warning here from 2009 about how to address the problem of liver injury related to the use of acetaminophen.
Yeah, hepatotoxicity is definitely a risk. What we can say is, okay, you avoid acetaminophen. What do I do if my kid has a fever? Right.
Right.
Just tell your doctor that you won't be using Tylenol and explore the options.
There are other options. Do you think that acetaminophen can raise the risk of autism being an outcome of that high fever?
I think the effect on the fever, the acetaminophen will certainly reduce the fever,
right.
But it has consequences that are not fever-related, such as, disabling the ability of the brain to, reduce the oxidative damage due to cellular stress, and you get oxygen species. That is a signal for microglial activation, so you're off to the races.
Right. You also talked about vitamin D. I presume you mean vitamin D deficiency. Like, how do we get vitamin D deficiency, and what role does that play?
Right. So vitamin D has a distribution in the population. It's a natural vitamin that the body does produce. Vitamin D3 in particular is the type that if you have a deficiency in it, it also confers some protection against neurological damage. So if we look at people's vitamin D3 levels, and this brings up a whole other area that's worth exploring. Medical doctors in the United States don't use contraindications properly. They're supposed to, by law, provide vaccine information sheets from the CDC.
Mm-hmm.
The vaccine information sheets from the CDC are not complete. But I think medical doctors routinely bring out vaccine information sheets and hand them to the patient.
Have they ever read them?
No, what the patient's experience is do you want to vaccinate today? You really shouldn't. You're a horrible parent if you don't.
Right.
Because you're one of those crazy anti-vaxxers, right?
Right.
So that kind of coercion replaces informed consent, and I'm leading a movement to update neurological development disorder science, and I also want to change the culture and change the tone of the discussion around vaccines altogether. We have the ability to screen patients based on contraindication criterions, and vitamin D levels in the blood might be one of them. You know, imagine what the medical community would do if they could say, you know, we really should screen for all these contraindications and do all this testing on kids before we vaccinate. That's a huge amount of billable services, and, you know, it's also a way to protect people. So,
right, things know, like body
the
weight.
The real risk, if you have a family member with autism, doesn't right. cost anything, right? So we need to be able to find ways of screening kids that are at most risk of autism from vaccines and not vaccinate them as the very first step towards bending the curve and reducing the risk of autism.
Right. Now, is it true that black people have a lower level of vitamin D because it's produced by sunshine and they're more protected from sunshine with a darker skin?
Yeah, I think that's fairly widely known. There's definitely heterogeneity in the population.
Right, and of course it was the black boys that you know, William Thompson was involved with removing from the studies.
That was one of the groups. The other group were so-called isolated autism group. There's two groups. People forget that it's not just the African American group. The isolated autism, that they defined it, were cases of autism that had no other conditions, such as seizures and so on. They just had autism for no apparent other biological reason other than the vaccine.
And they took those out. They said that's not really autism.
Yeah, they ended up with early on time MMR in isolated autism also had a significant result. That was removed from the publication.
That's not
the African Americans. That's everybody.
Right. No, I understand that. I understand it's two completely different groups. You also talked about ultrasound. I actually had a guest who had examined some of the Chinese research on ultrasound. I guess when a baby is aborted in China, there's an ultrasound first, and then they, in some cases, do an autopsy on the aborted fetus and have found things that are concerning. But do you have concerns about ultrasound?
Well, I review in the book the possibility that, you know, indiscriminate, unregulated use of ultrasounds may cause damage. We don't know if it opens up the blood-brain barrier. We don't know what it does necessarily to the placental barrier. There's systems that are designed to keep the infant, the fetus, immunologically separate from the mother as much as possible.
I mean, there's been a huge increase in the amount of ultrasound. My kids were born in the 80s and 90s, and I think my son, who was born in the 80s, didn't have an ultrasound, and I think my daughters, who were born in the 90s, had one ultrasound. But now people can go home with a portable ultrasound and look at the baby every day if they want.
Well, that's probably not the wisest thing to do.
I think it's only done by rich people, but that sounds crazy, because ultrasound sounds, you know, it's just sound, but it's kind of like comparing a flashlight to a laser beam, right? Like, you can look into a flashlight, no problem, but if you look into a laser beam, you might lose your sight. Like, the intensity and the frequency of the vibrations in ultrasound is like nothing that people have actually experienced in what they consider to be sound.
Yeah, so we definitely need more studies that focus on the question of whether or not ultrasounds have these undesired effect. Given their popularity and given, you know, the frequency and the ease of use and so on, I'm not sure that any more science is going to be coming forward on safety of ultrasounds anytime soon, but it should. If we can go back for a moment on the question of autism genetics, there is one finding in the literature that people should be aware of. Autistics tend to have a higher number of copy number variations. Let me tell you what copy number variations are.
Yeah, explain that.
De novo copy number variations are new mutations that occurred during the formation of the sperm or the egg in the parent. In other words, you see variation in the numbers of pieces of segments of the chromosome, of people, and they're highly heritable. So if you can inherit copy number variation from your parents.
Well, if there's a change in the sperm or egg cell, there's only one cell, and so that will go through the entire body. Whereas if you're a child or an adult and there's a change in one cell, it's basically insignificant unless it turns into a cancerous cell.
Exactly. So it's an open question as towards why these kids have higher numbers of copy number variations. It may be part of the reason is that their parents have been around longer. There is studies that show that older mom and dads have a higher risk of having autistic kids.
Right.
Slight increase in risk. Some people are misinformed in that and say it's just aging dads, but the science that I found was both moms and dads. But this is not blaming mom and blaming dad. Let's not get that wrong, because what this is saying the environmental toxicities in our environment are having an effect potentially by increasing the mutation, something in the environment, whether it's pesticides or air pollution or medical radiation. You know, a good colleague and friend of mine, Dr. Ted Fogarty, has hypothesized that perhaps the upshot in pelvic CT scans that are becoming more indiscriminately used.
Pelvic CT scans during pregnancy?
No, pelvic CT scans during the person's life. Exposure to radiation, CT, radiation, may be responsible. It's just a hypothesis. It has to be tested. But it may be responsible for increased numbers of copy number variations, which would go a long ways towards explaining why these kids have higher mutations, not just in environmental susceptibility genes, but perhaps across their genome. And therefore, we do have to get beyond this vaccines don't cause autism, and we have to do it now. Fine. Vaccines may cause autism in some people. Now, what are we going to do about it? Then we can ask interesting questions. We can say, okay, let's look at CT scans. And you can ask parents of kids with autism, look in their medical records. How many CT scans did you have? That can be one of these important covariates that we talked about earlier.
And the components of vaccines. I mean, if you open up your mind to say, that in some people vaccines can cause autism, the question is, is it the mercury? Maybe there was no mercury in the vaccines. Is it the aluminum? Is it some other component of the vaccines that's actually dangerous and should be removed, just like most mercury was removed when the CDC kind of admitted it was dangerous without actually admitting it?
No, absolutely. So what I was saying about the CT scan radiation, if we did a study and we found that CT scan the number of CT scans is correlated with autism, what the vaccine proponents are going to say is, oh, it's the CT scans, it's not autism. And that is not the correct conclusion. The correct conclusion would be the CT scans contribute to higher number of copy number variations. And the higher number of copy variations shut down the detoxification pathways, making these kids more susceptible to vaccines. So what should we do? We should screen for copy number variations in kids. We should look at their genetics and see if they're able to detoxify.
Right.
And if not, then don't vaccinate them.
It's very simple. Yeah, like saying we should maybe not be vaccinating preemies, that we should wait until they achieve a certain body weight before they're vaccinated, or there should be special reduced dose vaccines or something. I mean,
not one all. And my consortium, the Neurodevelopmental Research Consortium, wants to change that badly. We want to be able to ask all these important questions, and we have a list of characteristics, they're not all recognized contraindications, but risk factors. We have a list of suspected risk factors that should be considered in creating a modeling system where we can say we're going to screen people out of the vaccination. We're going to say no, we're going to contraindicate you for that, for vaccines. At the same time, we need to clean up the vaccines. We need to make vaccines that don't have proteins that match human proteins. unbelievably, the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge, scientists are working on identifying which proteins are in the vaccines that match human proteins perfectly. We talked about how, and other people have done this as well. There's other people like Ken Duke, who have looked at this autoimmunity that could be caused by molecular mimicry. So if a protein in a virus or a pathogen matches a human protein, it is absolutely accepted that you can get a pathogen infection that leads to autoimmunity. So you take that pathogen, you put it in a vaccine with an adjuvant, and then it causes autoimmunity because it matches the human protein, and then they say, no, you can't blame the vaccine?
We can't ask these questions right now because we're not allowed to talk about vaccines. I mean, one of the things that I saw in the Washington Post story, and I also read a similar story in the San Francisco Chronicle, was the media saying there is absolutely no connection. They're basically saying, although they probably are smart enough to never actually come out and say this, is that vaccines are totally safe, there are no side effects, and anybody who gets sick after a vaccine is just a random occurrence, right? They would have got sick anyway, it just so happens they got vaccinated the next day. Why is there a level of censorship on the vaccine study that's higher than the amount of censorship, for example, on pharmaceutical drugs? I mean,
there's
papers...
a couple of reasons. The first and foremost is that U.S. mainstream media, there's two countries in the world that have direct-to-consumer marketing. One is New Zealand, and the other is the United States. Mm-hmm. The number one source of revenue for media outlets in the United States is pharmaceutical direct-to-consumer marketing. It's huge. And so there have been people who have said that if any of their reporters talk about vaccines, they'll be fired because they're gonna lose their funding from pharma. So pharma's blackmailing the media. If we read anything in your paper or if you say anything on television against vaccines, and then they say you really want to do this for the right reasons because kids will die from measles or mumps and so on. If you don't, they're going to get these terrible childhood diseases, and so you're doing the right thing anyway. And so there's two motivations there, and the people say, well, we're doing right, and we're making money, so that sounds good. Okay, we'll do it. So there's a rationalization there. The problem is that when you the only thing that's being manipulated here is the perception of risk. There's a big difference between the manipulation of the perception of risk and actually reducing the risk. And so here's what I want to say. It is a mathematical certainty, regardless of the media, regardless of pharma, regardless of CDC, regardless of AMA, it's a mathematical certainty that every family in the United States and in every highly vaccinated country will get a vaccine-injured person in their family if they continue to add vaccines to the schedule with aluminum and mercury, and they don't clear out the epitopes that are unsafe. That means that the vaccine risk-aware community is going to grow. No,
yes.
Matter what.
Yes. I mean, okay. they have to, I agree that they have to deal with this. They're trying desperately. Like the Washington Post, to read again from this article, it says, it admits there's been a tenfold increase in autism. It's now 1 in 68 from 40 years earlier. But then they say, largely due to changes in how autism is defined and diagnosed. So
and
they...
That is not correct. There's a study that I cite in the book, The Environmental Genetic Causes of Autism, that actually analyzed the percentage that's due to changes in diagnosis. It is absolutely not correct. In U.S. classrooms, we have, you know, when I was a kid, we had maybe one kid with autism per grade, maybe, right?
Yes.
Maybe. And they weren't mainstream, so we'll give you that. But now in the classroom, you see one or two, maybe three kids on the spectrum. You see kids with allergies, you see kids with ectopic dermatitis, you see kids with, you know, all of these autoimmune disorders that we didn't see before. You've got ADHD is through the roof.
Right.
And one of the studies that the CDC never published was the association between any neurological developmental disorder and total vaccine toxin uptake in the form of mercury. And ADHD was one of them. And so when we know that there's an association between the exposure to toxins and vaccines and ADHD, and yet we're told that it's all due to overdiagnosis. Well, now they're trying, it's overdiagnosis and it's genetics. They're trying that on autism. And
well,
it's not
I mean, the same article in the Washington Post basically said, you know, quoted somebody saying it's caused by genes, and then the second thing said, well, actually, it's caused by overdiagnosis. Can't really be both.
It's not just when they say genes. They're not a geneticist. They don't know what they're talking about. This disorder, this condition, autism, is a combined effect of the largest studies that are available show that it is no more than 50% genetic. It is at least and probably much more than 50% environmental.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the genetic studies only look at genetics. So they're doomed to find genes. I say in the book that geneticists are doomed to find genes, okay?
And there's millions of genes to look for. So, I mean, if they keep looking long enough, they're going to come up with stuff, and they're going to come up with statistically significant correlations, which might actually in real life be meaningless, like a lot of statistical significance.
Right. The law of large numbers, if you do, you know, 3 billion statistical tests, 5% of them are going to be significant. So the more genetics that they look at, the more genes they'll find. But what I did in this book is I looked at the genes that have repeatedly been found to be associated with mm-hmm. autism with multiple studies and the ones that make biological sense. And so, yes, there is a genetic risk component. There's an genetic environmental susceptibility component. And there's heritability and traits that we associate with autism that are not necessarily contributing to the diagnosis of autism. But the important point here is that none of the genetic studies, none of them that I found, looked at the interaction between genetic and any environmental factor. And if you don't look at that in genetics, when we look at traits, we talked about heritable traits, we talked about floral petal flowers, we talked about simple right. traits and complex mm-hmm. traits. Every study that's done that in genetics knows is designed considering genetics and environment and genetic by environment interactions. G by E is a very specific term in a genetic model. And so for them to say it's genetic, they're trying to make people think it's like hair color or that it's like eye color, and there's no way. Listen, kids with autism don't have parents that have autism.
Yes, and I mean, there's lots of stories of like two brothers who are very, very similar, and then one of them suddenly comes down with autism at following vaccines. It's a little hard to believe that, you know, it was a genetic condition that just suddenly, you know, got activated at the age of 5 or 6 and turned the kid's life upside down while the other kid had no effect. But I mean, I think the combination of genes and environmental factors kind of helps explain, you know, if we were all sensitive to mercury, then we would all have autism. We would all have, you know, serious disorders after vaccination, and most people don't. So that you know, a combination of those two things makes a whole lot more sense.
Absolutely. So I mean, you hit the nail on the head. You know, we can speculate whether vaccines have changed all of us. All of us may be changed in some way, but we can't know how. You know, the good news here, very positive note, all the parents of vaccine-injured kids that have autism and other disorders that follow me and support me, they've banded together, and they're actually spreading the word about my book, The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism. They're actually purchasing the book and having it sent to pediatricians. So the AMA, the Washington Post, New York Times, whoever's criticizing, you know, anybody who says that vaccines may cause autism, the science is settled and all that, they can't stop these thousands and thousands of parents who are wanting to desperately educate their pediatricians. And the nice thing about that is they're not doing it for themselves. Their child is already vaccine injured.
Right, it's not going to make any difference.
These are altruistic parents who are looking after other families' parents,
right.
And they're wonderful people. They have so much love in their heart that they're willing to look past the hurt that was done to them as a family and so on, and they still come back at society, and they still say, look, we care about you all. We want you to avoid this. We don't want anybody to have to suffer through the experience our families suffered through, although we love our child to death, and they do, you know.
Right.
They absolutely love their kid. And I just think that's beautiful. and they're my source of inspiration.
I mean, it's a lot harder, I think. I mean, it's when your child is injured in some way physically or whatever, you have to put a lot more energy into the relationship. You have to spend more time with a child to try to, you know, improve their educational level. You might have to change their diapers, things like that.
Some people, you get to do that because, you know, my mom died of breast cancer when I was very young.
Mm-hmm.
And get a chance to, and I'm sure that, you know, if I was vaccine injured or had autism, she'd want that time with me.
Yes.
So the point is, anybody listening to your show, if you want to send a copy of the book to a pediatrician, there's a website for it called projectpediatric.com, and if it, we'll put a link up on when I share the show,
right.
The recorded show. So that they can send a copy of this book, and there's other resources that are going to be there soon as well. We're going to put up Thimerosal, Let the Science Speak by RFK. They can send a copy of my book and Vaxxed, in the movie Vaxxed in combination,
mm-hmm.
to the pediatrician's office, and help spread the word about the actual state of science, because pediatricians are being misled by CDC. They're being misled by AMA. We have to change the culture, the scope of the discussion. We have to change the culture from manipulation and management of risk perception to actual changing the risk. And you know, the fact that the AMA came out and said that it's okay to refuse medical care for kids of parents who are vaccine risk aware is absolutely stunning. They sanctioned that. They said that was okay. You can turn kids away from medical care if they're not vaccinated in the United States. And that's according to the AMA. Well, that's not the conversation that the parents who want to have informed consent. We have rights. We have rules and regulations and laws guaranteeing our right to informed consent. And if we're being denied informed consent by being told that we're crazy, we're being told that, you know, we shouldn't ask these questions because we're going to hurt our kids.
Karen Rimley, the executive director of the American Academy of Pediatrics in the Washington Post, said, "It is dangerous to public health to suggest that vaccines are linked to autism."
Well, I would say back to that person, it's dangerous to continue to deny vaccine risk-induced autism because you're going to cause more autism. And by causing more autism, you're going to cause more vaccine risk awareness. And by causing more vaccine risk awareness, you're going to reduce the rates of vaccine uptake. They're doing it, not us.
Right. I think we could talk quite a bit longer, but I would say that people, if they want to learn more about the connections between environmental and genetic causes of autism, that they read your book. I'll include links to the websites in the show notes. Is there any final words you'd like to say before we close out?
I want to say to everyone, well, first of all, to you, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure. Everyone, to keep talking about it, keep sharing what you learn. Learn the science. Talk to your neighbors. Talk to your friends. You know, the stress that is put on by these discussions around vaccine are destroying relationships. But those people will come back to you when they become more informed. It's inevitable one day that everyone will know that vaccines are behind this autism epidemic. The question is not whether it does or it does not. The question is, what are we going to do about it?
Yes, and we can't do something about it until we start talking about it. And if the two sides are shouting at each other, we're never going to get anywhere.
Exactly.
And I really think that the establishment, by saying things like it's dangerous to public health, are shouting at people who have questions about vaccines, and not necessarily reject all vaccines, but want safer vaccines, want less vaccines, want them spread out more. That's not a conversation you're allowed to have these days. I would just like to thank you so much for being on my show today. I really appreciate it, and I encourage people to read your book.
All right, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Goodbye. Well, how can I not talk about Donald Trump this week? I can't even remember how it started, but there was the executive order to start the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which to me just illustrates that Donald Trump is lying to both sides. He's lying to his base because he has said he's going to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. But the Republicans kind of admit that they have to replace it with something. They can't take 20 million people and remove their health insurance from them. So they might nibble around the edges, and there will be some sacrificial victims, and there will be a lot of gnashing of teeth on both sides. But in the end, he won't destroy the Affordable Care Act, but he might make some serious vandalism to it. So he will keep nobody happy. And I think this is what the Republican Party is really scared of. They're now in a situation where they got to fish or cut bait. They've been talking about the Affordable Care Act for a long time, and they really don't have a replacement. This is what Rand Paul said, a man I respect somewhat, although not as much as his father. "What should we replace Obamacare with?" says Rand Paul. "Perhaps we should try freedom. One, the freedom to choose inexpensive insurance free of government dictates. Two, the freedom to save unlimited amounts in a health savings account. Three, the freedom to buy insurance across state lines. Four, the freedom for all individuals to join together in voluntary associations to gain the leverage necessary to negotiate." I hate to say it, but this is about the most juvenile thing I've heard in a long time. There will be no inexpensive insurance free of government dictates. If the government doesn't dictate that insurance actually covers something useful, you will find that the cheap insurance you got is actually worthless. The freedom to save unlimited amounts in a health savings account is great if you got lots of money, but it doesn't do anything to help the poor. The freedom to buy insurance across state lines will probably have a marginal, minimal effect on insurance because there will be more competition, but there's already tons of competition in the insurance market, and all the insurance companies agree that they're going to charge high prices and deny coverage and make lots of money. And then the freedom for all individuals to join together in voluntary associations sounds a lot like the cooperatives that was a part of the Affordable Care Act that was set up to fail. So if this is the best the Republicans can do, it's just not going to work. As they say, he's lying to both sides. So then there is the thing that about the election and how there were 2, 3, 4 million, I don't know how many million illegal immigrants who voted in the election. Absolutely no evidence from any credible source about this. The Democrats say that the election was hacked by Russia. I've found no credible evidence for that. I've been a computer expert for a long time, and nothing I've read gives me any assurance that there's anything in the whole Russian story. What stole the election? Well, it's very clear. The Electoral College gave the election to somebody who didn't win the majority of the votes, and voter suppression suppressed the Black and Hispanic vote through things like cross-check. And I haven't even got to the immigration question. I guess I'll have to leave that till next week. I would just like to thank you for listening to episode 130 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.